Welcome everybody to episode 80 of High Tech on the Low. Ron, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. We're sitting here with Ron Gonen, founder and CEO of Closed Loop Partners, which we are going to get to in a little bit. As always, we are sponsored by Front Team with six verticals, 12 communities, and 3,000 members all looking to connect. And as always, you can throw us a subscribe, a follow, or a like on anything, on any of the platforms, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to our lovely show today. And today, I'm very excited to actually talk to you, Ron, because, you know, one of my kind of like, you know, passion projects, I guess you could say, is the world of sustainability and the world of, you know, the green revolution. I've been into this kind of world for honestly the last, you know, it's weird for me to say, and I'm young, right? I'm not even the one with the gray hair here, but, you know, I've been in it for almost a decade, like in a former capacity, and even before that in high school. And I'm very, very interested in, you know, the whole idea of the circular economy has also come to note and everything. And I just want to hear a little bit more about, you know, what you guys are doing at Closed Loop Partners. And we're going to talk a little bit about this kind of revolution you guys are leading, as well as also a recent competition that you guys were all involved in. So, Ron, take it away. Give us a little background about yourself.
Sure. So I'm the founder and CEO of Closed Loop Partners. Closed Loop Partners is focused on building the circular economy. Mm. What we mean by the circular economy is a move away from extractive resources to manufacture products. So extracting oil to make plastic, extracting ore to make metal, cutting down trees to make paper. And then after those products are used, moving away from disposing of them in landfills. A circular economy is one in which we're manufacturing products without the need for extraction of resources, without the need for disposal in landfill. We're continually reusing those materials in a system that ends up saving all of us a lot of money and preserving our environment. Mm-hmm. So that's the focus of my firm. How I got here is...
it's always an interesting one, right?
is I had to get a job when I was in middle school, going into high school, and... by chance, I ended up working for a family, babysitting, fixing things around their house.
Okay.
And the dad became one of the first green architects in America. And at the time, he was in his mid to late 30s, which I viewed as old at that time. And he decided to leave his very promising architectural career at a prestigious firm. This is all in the late 80s and start a green architecture firm. And I distinctly remember people thinking that he was being incredibly irresponsible. He was recently married, two young kids. What is this guy doing? But something about his passion, his dedication, but also the way he talked about the world made sense to me. And that was really the seed for my journey in building a career in sustainability.
And you just kind of joined his mission and from there kind of like learned your way up the ladder, if you would?
I learned a lot from him in high school. And then when I came out of college, I came out of college in the mid to late 90s, it was the first high tech boom. And I kind of had a choice to make in terms of what I was going to do with my life. And I had kind of three tracks. I could go down the academic track and go get a PhD in history and economics, which I was passionate about, or I could go become sort of an environmental activist, or I could go learn business. And fortunately, I decided to go into an area that I didn't have background in, I didn't have a comfort level in, but I thought would be really valuable to me. And I went to work in management consulting at what's today Accenture, what was at the time Anderson Consulting.
Okay.
And I spent 6 years there, and it was an incredibly useful experience for me because I learned about management, I learned about business, I learned about technology, I learned about what works in business, what doesn't work in business.
Of course.
So then I ended up going back to business school in my late 20s with the specific purpose of trying to start a business in the sustainability space. Now, when I went back to business school in 2002 and I walked into orientation, this is at Columbia Business School in New York, and people were being asked, what do you want to do when you graduate from Columbia Business School? It was sort of iBanking or management consulting. That was
What did you say? That's my main question. I want to know what you said.
I said, I'm here to build a business focused on sustainability that's going to show that operating a business with sustainable practices is the way to optimize returns.
That's ambitious. That's ambitious.
Total silence. Total silence.
They probably thought you were nuts. They were probably like, what is this guy even talking about?
You know, they did think I was nuts. And also they felt a little sorry for me. They were kind of like, but how are you going to pay your tuition? Like, how are you going to pay back your loans if you do that? And then a few people kind of had, I think, what they considered a eureka moment. They're like, we got it. So
the other crazies in the room understood you too. Okay.
when some Columbia Business School graduate gets arrested for white collar crime at their hedge fund or PE firm, Columbia will be able to point to you and be like, wait, we also graduate people that focus on, you know, fixing things in the world and making the world a better place. He hasn't made any money, but we graduated him and he's trying to make the world a better place. And people were like, now we got it. You're like a token. They let you in as a token.
Right. The mission is good, but the pocketbook may be a little empty. It's
okay.
Yeah,
like we don't get it exactly, but there's something going on. There's something going on here. Why this guy's here? But long story short, I co-founded my first business in business school, which is a recycling company called Recycle Bank, and Columbia Business School was the seed investor in the business.
Wow, that's actually quite the move then. Thinking about where you started coming in and no one even understood you to the point where they're actually being one of your top supporters, early supporters even.
Yes. And so I was very fortunate. So a year and a half later, I'd started this business and Columbia had a fund that invested in student businesses. And at this point in my career, I'm very fortunate to have been able to raise over $1 billion for my different ventures. Mm-hmm. But that first $100,000 that I got was by far the most important. And I still remember to this day exactly where I was when I got a call from Cliff Shore at Columbia Business School who said, we're going to invest $100,000 in your business. And I thought I had made it at that point. I was like, I raised $100,000. The investor is Columbia Business School.
Better can you go, right?
I've got a name.
$100,000. Would you also say, like, do you think it's like, you know, one of the things when I sometimes sit with entrepreneurs, right, you know, everyone talks about the raise, right? Everyone talks about going for it. Is it true what they say in your mind that the first 100,000 is the hardest and everything after that is kind of, I wouldn't say maybe easy, but whatever. It's like a little easier.
In general, yes. I think every capital raise is situational to that specific capital raise. But I think once you've raised your first round of financing, whatever you're doing, that's a big step that puts you at another level, no matter how much the capital is that you're raising.
Sure.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that things get easier after that. Capital raising, I think, is always a challenge and always complex, but it gives you a base level of experience and a track record that's very valuable.
And it kind of makes people like look at you and say, at minimum, maybe even your venture and even you, and say, okay, this guy obviously got some people behind him. He's not a lone wolf in the sea right now trying to just go do something. He knows what he's up to.
Definitely.
And obviously names like Columbia Business School certainly help.
Yeah, I mean, that was incredibly helpful that I had their brand behind me. And to take it further, they ended up selling their equity a few years later for about a 10x return. So they did really well by me, by backing me when I had no track record and just an idea. And you know, fortunately, I was able to do well for them by providing them a good financial exit, but more importantly, an example that they could make money backing companies and entrepreneurs that were trying to do something good.
Right. That wasn't just kind of the big money movements of Wall Street or, you know, kind of corporate world, Fortune 500. I think that's so important, you know, what you're bringing up here, because, you know, one of the things that, you know, you really brought up right now is this whole idea of kind of the economy of sustainability, right? Where does it come from? And how can we also make business processes, in a sense, you know, that work, right? That work and show that, you know, sustainability, the green revolution is actually something that's not just good for the planet, but actually good for the pocketbook, good for your bottom line. I'd love to understand, you know, a little bit, you know, in closed loop, exactly how do you guys reach your, you know, kind of your clientele, if you will, with this message? Because in my mind, I think as much as people really care about sustainability and care about the green revolution, you know, there's a lot more talk about it than there is action on it. And I think it's largely because of money. But I'd love to understand how you guys go about it.
We hustle. And
good answer.
and when we got to take a break from hustling, we get in a room and try to be super strategic. But our firm is unique in that we were founded by a number of major global consumer goods companies. So the first investors in Closed Loop Partners funds were Walmart, Unilever, PepsiCo,
okay,
Nestle, P&G, 3M, Colgate-Palmolive.
So large companies, large established companies. Yeah.
Yeah. So from the start, we had this deal flow coming to us from those large corporates, or we had them telling us, hey, these are the critical bottlenecks in our supply chains that if you could find someone to solve it, that's a good investment. So that was one source of our deal flow. The other source of our deal flow is we're very heavy on the operator side.
Okay.
Of our personnel. Obviously, we have very successful fund managers and people with investment track record. But I think one thing that makes us unique is we're very heavy on the operator side, meaning we have former CEOs, CFOs, people that worked in government, and they have their own relationships within industry where when people find out they've come here or they're talking to different people, they can source a good deal flow for us.
Yeah, for sure. And that, I guess, makes a lot of sense having kind of, you know, different arms out there. My, you know, I want to kind of ask, and I think it's probably a question a lot of my viewers might be, you know, having right now as they listen, is kind of how did you get these major companies to be on board from the start? Because obviously a lot of, you know, a lot of companies, the dream is to reach these companies, right? Is to be integrated into their systems, whether it's through a pilot or even if it's through true like business operations, to really push their product forward or push their idea, you know, forward or solution, whatever it is. How did you guys get them, you know, early on? Was it really just kind of they believed in the mission, or you had prior connections, or a mix? What was it?
It was a combination of a few things. So first, it was a track record built over a number of years. And so my first company, Recycle Bank, had a number of corporate partnerships.
Okay. That's important, obviously.
Right. And then I moved into government where I was overseeing a major agency that involved their businesses.
Okay.
And so by the time I started talking to them about Closed Loop Partners, I had a 10-year relationship with them. So I was a known entity. I built value for them.
Right. They could trust you.
There was trust there. So that was one part of it. The other part of it was that they were coming to a realization about supply chains and manufacturing way before the financial community was.
Okay.
They were recognizing that the supply chains that had been built 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s that relied on cheap labor in emerging markets, relaxed or no environmental regulations in emerging markets, very little transparency for the consumer into supply chains, and very cheap logistics. That economy no longer existed. Labor rates had gone up in emerging markets. Environmental regulation was getting stricter.
Right.
There was way more transparency now. Like someone could just, you know, film a outsourced manufacturing company in Malaysia dumping in a river and post it on social media, and all of a sudden these companies are mired in a scandal, whereas 30 years ago that would have taken a reporter flying over and finding out how to get in there and getting their Nikon camera out and taking pictures and developing the pictures and, you know, getting them into that, you know.
No, a whole different world. The whole world of, you know, distribution and media became a lot flatter in that sense. Okay.
And so they were way ahead of the financial community and were looking around and saying, hey, we got to start figuring out how to reimagine our supply chains. And so we kind of came along at the right time talking about we would like to work on reimagining and rebuilding supply chains. Now, what was interesting about that was I got a firsthand glimpse as to how antiquated the financial services industry can be in their thinking, because when I was having conversations with a Unilever, a Nestle, PepsiCo, and their executive teams around their interest in reimagining their supply chains, becoming more transparent, becoming more sustainable, becoming more domestic.
Right.
As I was talking with the financial services community, they were telling me these companies have no interest in this. They're never going to change, et cetera, et cetera.
And so really?
I got a firsthand glimpse into how much the financial services industry can be rooted in legacy and antiquated models and just continue to sort of talk about it, invest in it, without the public or their clients being aware that they're really not doing their homework. They're not actually talking to people who are actually in those industries and the operators about where they're trying to go to. So,
let me just ask real fast. So you're saying like the financial system basically there is kind of basically saying we know best. I mean, that's what it almost sounds like.
They were like, we all, on one hand, they'll say, we're all looking for innovation. On another hand, they'll say, we all want to go into social networks. Or like, I'm looking for the next social network, right? And then it was like, we all want innovation. And it was like, then Uber came out. It was like, we all want to be in mobility. We're all looking for mobility.
Right, we're all going to transportation tech. Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of like whatever innovation is the flavor of that year, everybody in the financial services industry goes into that and sort of puts a flag down to their clients and says, I'm being innovative because I'm looking for something in this space. But if you take a step back, you realize, wait, everybody's running into this space. The people that truly make money as investors are people that look at everybody going into that space and say, well, I'm going to take a step back here and I'm going to look by my left and I'm going to look to my right and I'm going to look up and I'm going to look down and I'm going to find something that I think is truly disruptive, truly innovative that no one else is investing in. And that's how I get good pricing, good terms, and good exits.
That's really interesting, though. That whole kind of, I would almost call it like disconnect between like the enterprise and you know the financial institutions, which is kind of funny that you bring up because even not too long ago in one of my episodes, you know, one of the guests, he literally said, the first to always adapt, you know, and adopt innovation, we can say, are the enterprises, followed by the financial institutions, followed by government. It almost seems that you're saying like the financial institution's totally off base. Like they don't even know what the heck's going on. Oh, wow.
I'll give you an example. Adam Neumann and WeWork.
Okay. Let's talk about
After that debacle. Do you think the financial services community got together and said, this keeps happening. How do we avoid doing this again? We back some entrepreneur that's thrown a bunch of crap up on the wall. We all know it's BS, but hopefully we can spin a story and take it public and then get out with our returns and leave the public with all this hanging. Like, we just can't do this anymore. Like, let's be really introspective.
So what did they actually do?
Nothing. They said
business as usual.
Is there another one out there that's maybe not as obnoxious or as extreme? And we can sort of, get that one passed.
Right.
And then Adam Neumann came back around and raised a bunch of money.
Which is still amazing to me, but you're so right, because at the end of the day, it shows, and I think it goes back to like your whole idea here, which is this whole, you know, economic model, the circular economic model. Like, how do you prove that this whole innovation, this whole revolution is just good for your books, you know? And right. I think in doing that, you can almost bring them, you know, through. Now, one thing I want to bring up here, and this is kind of important, is this whole competition that you were recently involved in. And I was wondering, or are you still involved in it? Is it still going on?
In Israel or
which? Right, the Toyota backlog.
It's a competition looking for, so it's run by Toyota in Israel.
What's the full name, just for everyone out there?
It's the Earth Prize for Israel.
Earth Prize for Israel. Okay.
And it's looking for entrepreneurs that are developing a solution that could help preserve the environment, and it's a million shekel prize whoever the committee chooses has the best idea that's scalable.
Cool. So, and why specifically was it done in Israel? Is it like a hotbed of, you know, green tech in that sense, or what's the idea there?
Well, I think there's a few components to it. One is the company and the family that's backing it is the family and company that owns Toyota in Israel. So
okay,
that's,
well,
that's
that
the,
makes it easy.
that's the Toyota piece of it.
Sure.
It's really Toyota Israel that's doing it. So they're focused on Israel. And then I think they've done some of these prizes in other areas over the past years and have found a lot of success with it. And I think, yeah, Israel has become a source of some of the most advanced technologies in clean tech. And in a sense, it's always been that because it's always been a leader in water,
right,
and
right.
irrigation.
Right. We now, go back to the drip, you know, drip irrigation and, you know, desalination, of course.
Totally, totally. Right. So actually, Israel has always been a leader in the space, but now it's expanding from a specific focus on just water to all other areas of the circular economy and sustainable economy. Our firm aggressively invests in Israel. We have four portfolio companies in,
wow.
in Israel that we're really proud of. And I think Naftali Bennett, maybe 2 years ago, said something really important, which is the high tech community needs to stop just making games and focus on building
like real actionable solutions, things that are going to take us forward.
Real actual solutions. Uh-huh. And so, yeah, I think Israel has a great opportunity to be a leading exporter of these types of solutions, as well as use these solutions domestically in Israel as well.
Very, very interesting. Now, you know, one of the kind of things I want to understand from your perspective, you know, you have, I mean, it sounds like you have almost, what is it, close to 30, 40 years of understanding of this field. You've seen a lot of the evolution, you know, of what's been going on in green tech, in the circular economy, whatever it might be called in that specific decade. And I kind of want to know what you see as the trends for the next, let's say, decade, now that we're in the 20s, going to the 30s. Everyone's talking about, you know, the world getting warmer, you know, massive migrations due to global climate change, whatever it might be, wars. What do you see as being the trends right now to help kind of, you know, I wouldn't say solve climate change, but at least mitigate it?
Use three examples.
Okay.
One is there's a major resource that we pay to stick in the ground, which is food waste.
Okay.
So today, our food waste, we just throw it in the garbage. Then we pay for a truck that has fuel in it to come
right.
and pick up food waste, drive it, and stick it in a hole. And then we use more fuel to drive that truck back to the garage.
It's crazy. Now, when you put it like that, I have to tell you, it's freaking nuts that we do that.
It is. It is. Because today there's technologies being led by an Israeli company that's a portfolio company of ours called Home Biogas.
Okay.
Where you can now process your food waste on site and turn it into either gas for cooking or hot water. So I'll give you an example. Kibbutz Yagur,
okay.
which is in the north.
Okay.
All right. All of the landfills in Israel are in the south. So
okay.
Kibbutz Yagur used to pay for a hauler to drive their truck, pick up all of their garbage, which was mostly food waste,
sure.
then drive it to the south, pay to stick it in a hole, which is a landfill, and then that truck would drive back to its garage. It required a lot of fuel, created a lot of pollution,
sure.
caused a lot of traffic,
right.
and cost Kibbutz Yagur a lot of money.
Right.
Now, if you go visit Kibbutz Yagur, outside of the cafeteria, there's a home biogas system. When everyone is done eating, they put their food down a sink that has a grinder. The food automatically goes to the home biogas system that's in the parking lot. And the home biogas system converts the food waste into gas that's now heating their hot water.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. That's actually incredible.
So now Kibbutz Yagur has gotten rid of the cost of disposing of their food waste, number one. Number two is they're reducing their energy costs. So 20 years from now, 30 years from now, we'll tell kids what we used to do with our food waste is we throw it in the garbage. Then twice a week, we take it out to the curb. A truck would come by, pick it up, drive an hour away, pay to stick it in a hole. Right? We tell them like the whole story and they'd be like, what are you talking about?
Like, why did you guys even do that in the first place?
Like you just put the food waste in your home biogas system and you create gas.
Right.
It's no different than today. We're like, when I tell my kids, when I had to make a phone call when I was a kid, and that was not that long ago, that was the 80s and 90s, right? When I had to make a phone call when I was a kid in my house, I said I would go to the kitchen and I'd use the phone.
Right. And they're like, but Dad, you don't just have it in your pocket?
Well, my kids go, oh, because your phone was charging there? I go, no.
Wow.
That's the phone for the house was in the kitchen. And they're like, they just can't comprehend. It'll be the same thing around food waste. People will be like, but you paid to. And so that's a really innovative technology, an example of how we can take a resource that today we're completely wasting and turn it into renewable energy. I would say another major innovation we're going to see is on the regulatory side.
Okay.
I think for
kind of governments moving in the direction of actually saying you have to do X, Y, and Z. Otherwise, we don't give you compliance and you're not allowed to sell and you're not allowed to do business here or whatever it might be.
Well, or they're going to be more effective in appropriately distributing costs. So what I mean by that is I can sell a plastic product in the market.
Okay.
I sold it. I booked the revenue. I get my profit. Gamalno, I'm done.
Okay.
The customer finishes using that plastic product. They throw it in the garbage. Now, who pays for it to go to landfill? The way the system has been set up is we all collectively pay. Whether or not you bought that product or I bought that product, if our neighbor bought that product and threw it in the garbage, we all collectively in our tax bill.
Right. You're paying it just as much as I'm paying it, for sure.
Garbage disposal. And meanwhile, the company is sitting back and they collected their revenue and collected their profit. And that type of system needs to change where either the company is responsible for the cost of it going to landfill, which would then force them to innovate around, you know, promoting more recycling.
Right.
Or you turn waste into a utility like electricity or water.
Right.
Where you don't pay for your neighbor's electricity. You don't pay for your neighbor's water.
Right.
Likewise, you're no longer going to share in the cost of your neighbor's garbage. The government's going to say, look, we'll give you a bill for the size of container you need. It's up to you.
Right.
So that's another major innovation that I think we'll be seeing here. And we're already seeing it in the EU.
Right.
We're already seeing it in California. So there's a lot of innovation taking place in the technology space, also in government. I could go on and on.
Right.
But those are the two areas that I would highlight.
What's interesting too, because one of the things that you're also bringing up is there's this kind of shift in mentality that's going to have to happen too, where people are going to have to also start realizing that some of the processes and the systems that we're doing right now, whether or not we think they are forever or are working or whatever, are not actually the systems that are going to be the long-term things that are going to help us move forward. And I think that's very, very real.
Absolutely. And look, a lot of the system, especially in the United States, where people sort of say, that's the birthplace of capitalism, it's the free market. When you pull back the curtain, there you can't find an industry in the United States that didn't get to scale because of government funding. So take a moment and absorb that. That's very different than what we learn in school, that America is all about capitalism, all about free markets. The automotive industry did not build the roads or the highways.
Right.
If they had to build the roads and the highways, they never would have gotten to scale. They wouldn't have had enough money. The airline industry did not build the airports. Mm-hmm. They never could have gotten to scale. They don't have enough money. The government built the roads, the government built the airports. And you can find that in every industry in America. And so unfortunately, the system in the U.S. has been structured where some industries are getting a lot of funding that don't necessarily work to the benefit of society. The oil and gas industry, as much as the CEOs of those companies like to pump their chests and say it's all about capitalism, it's all about free market, they get billions of dollars in subsidies from the federal and state taxpayers, and in turn that ends up creating climate change. So it's kind of like we're money to industries that end up hurting us, and we'd be better off saying, hey, you polluting industries, it's a free market, like you can go and operate if you want to,
right?
We're just not going to.
We're not going to support you, right? Or if you do, we're gonna punish you to a certain degree, even, and we're gonna try to de-incentivize you from that.
Yeah, well, if you break the law, we're gonna punish you. But it, you know, there may not be an environmental law in the book. There may not be this regulation on the book. I think just simply starting from the base level of, we're just not going to subsidize you.
And you think that would be enough?
Yes. Yes. Wow. Because they receive so much in subsidies that getting rid of those subsidies would increase their costs to a point in which their product now becomes more expensive, less attractive.
Well, Ron, I want to literally say that I want to end on that, because that is a great note to end on for our discussion here. I think it's a very key thing for people to understand as well as getting into this space. So, Ron, I want to say thank you so much for coming on the show and giving your insights on the world of, you know, the circular economy and the green revolution. And it was a great pleasure having you on the show.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.